Closing the door to the museum, JB locked it with a click and stood to join the others on the front steps. Washed, fed, and well-rested, the other companions were spread out in a defensive arc with their backs to the museum and blasters held ready. Just for a moment, JB thought he heard somebody calling a name, and then it was gone, carried away on the breeze. The plaza of the building was alive with scavengers, insects of every kind, and flocks of rustling birds, mostly black buzzards. They had arrived during the night, hundreds of them, along with some vultures. Normally bitter enemies, constantly fighting over every scrap of food, now the birds roosted side by side, stuffing themselves on the dried human flesh that lay sprawled in the streets in such abundance. Trying to hide it, Doc was repulsed by the sounds. The noise of the feasting was horrible. It reminded him of pigs at the trough, and he forced away the madness that welled at that dark memory. Away from the bloodless carnage, a smoky pall hung over the city, thick clouds swirling along the streets, distant reddish lights showing new buildings burning out of control, mingling with the occasional crash of falling masonry and splintering wood.
You all know how I'm always pushing for us to wreck just a little more and try to salvage more technology, medicine, whatever? Well, not this time. We're standing in the middle of a powder keg, and we can't leave fast enough.
I second that.
Christy glanced around at the other buildings and stores near the museum. Her hair was strangely still, its lack of motion showing her deep concern.
The question still remains, though. How do we get out of here? 100 feet straight up is a hell of a climb.
We've done it before.
JB tilted back his hat to survey the sprawling metropolis.
But only as a last resort.
Every building seemed to be crawling with birds and other scavengers. More winged creatures were circling the exposed city, some of them soaring between the buildings and roosting amid the gargoyles and spires of a cathedral. The stained glass windows were about the only glass remaining intact.
Hell of a climb, so we'd best try and find something else before we go grabbing bastard rock.
Walking along the steps, his presence caused a stir among the birds, and he worked the bolt action on the stire without conscious thought. As if understanding the action, the birds moved away from the man to feed on other corpses. Only the vultures stayed, arching their snake-like necks in annoyance as they gobbled down ragged pieces of dried flesh. The companions were closest to the northern side of the cliff, the smoke thin enough to see the vertical rock wall of the sinkhole. There were a lot of cracks and even a few ravines, but nothing that would offer a route to the surface. The sinkhole made a hell of a trap, and once inside, there was no easy way out. They were like rats in a garbage can, with the open sky directly above, but no way to reach it.
Buried alive.
Mildred's words carried on the morning breeze, much farther than she had expected. Just then, a soft, familiar hooting sounded from the burning city, and the companions turned together, fingers tightening on triggers. A few blocks away, a humanoid figure was clinging to the side of a luxury hotel, holding onto the stonework with one arm, while the other was batting at the birds swooping close to feed on the helpless prey. But as one vulture got too near, the humanoid grabbed a flapping wing. As the vulture frantically tried to get free, the man-like being released its grip of the wall, but stayed oddly secure to the flat stonework with just bare feet as it tore the screaming vulture apart in an explosion of bloody feathers. Screaming their rage, the other vultures flapped away.
Stickies! Mother Gaia, protect us! Everything in the desert must be heading this way!
When the dust dome cracked, it must have been visible for dozens of miles.
Probably hundreds of miles. We need to wreck the rock face, and the top of a building would give the best view. Just need some place the fire hasn't reached yet.
Oh, stickies.
Jack checked the clinking bag at his side. The museum had been full of useful items, and now they had 8 Molotovs made from wine bottles, carpet stain cleaner, vodka, and some odd chems. Since JB was hauling the majority of the lead pipe bombs, Jack had opted to carry the heavy Molotovs. Besides, he was better at throwing things than the armorer.
The direction we came from looks okay.
As JB used his Navy scope to check the building, Ryan squinted at the structure. Sure enough, the central office building wasn't yet on fire, but the flames were close, reflecting on the sides of the structure.
Too risky. Once we reached the top, the fire could jump, and we'd be trapped for sure.
JB lowered the long eyes and compacted it before tucking it away.
Nothing else looks any better. What ain't on fire yet is blocked by the buildings that are.
So we walk the skirt. It'll be a while before the fire reaches the outskirts, so anything there we can use to wreck, or as a ladder to climb out.
You really think we're gonna find something?
You got a better idea, start talking.
JB merely grunted in reply, and fell into step with his friend, the stubby barrel of the 9mm Uzi, regularly sweeping the street and sidewalks before them in a steady pattern. Crossing the street, the companions put the feeding birds in their wake and maneuvered through a morass of cars, all jammed together in neat rows. The machines had to have been in gear, held in place purely by the pressure of the driver's foot on the brake when the world ended. As the corpses went limp, the vehicle surged ahead, but only for a few feet before slamming into one another and forming an orderly crash that stretched for blocks. Halfway through the crumpled vehicles, Ryan heard a faint moan and walked closer to a black limo to touch the hood. The metal was vibrating slightly under his fingertips. How the hell could the horn still be operating 100 years later? Unless the engine had a nuke battery for a power source. But that was for millwags only, and not even every one of them got the unique devices. Studying the driver and passengers, Ryan deduced it was some sort of a govwag, loaded with the barons of their day. Oddly, there seemed to be movement amid the passengers, and he instinctively swung up his blaster as protection. A black millipede crawled into view from under the jacket of a corpse, then several more from the other corpses. The bugs were everywhere inside the limo, and Ryan could only guess that the things had been attracted by the mag field of the still-working horn. For some reason, they were drawn to mag fields the way a shark was to blood in the water. Mildred had tried explaining it once, but the white coat jargon was out of his league. However, the fact remained that bugs liked mag fields. Away from the traffic jam, a lifeless mob of people filled the sidewalk and street in front of a movie theater, and the companions had no choice but to walk on the dead, the desiccated bodies crunching under their boots like autumn leaves. Heading for the cliff, Ryan turned a corner and stopped. The intersection was clear of traffic, the bodies of police lying before the side streets full of cars, and some sort of a mill convoy parked forever at a stoplight. Motorcycles flanked an unmarked armored truck, the driver and passenger both openly carrying shotguns. The local cops had been holding back civilian wags for the military wags to get through. Christy looked under the vehicle for any more millipedes.
Must have been important folks.
Or they were carrying something important.
Dean checked the fallen motorcycles.
Prob just gold or some other useless stuff.
The boy knew that far too many folks had wasted precious time and effort busting open armored wags, only to find them stuffed with jack, jewelry, or pieces of silver. Totally useless. The paper jack was too stiff to use for wiping your ass, and silver was too soft to make ammo. Of course, JB knew how to make explosives from pre-dark money and silver coins, but he and Ryan were the only folks still alive who could do that. Dean knew most of the procedure, but it was damn tricky, and one mistake put you on the last train west in a hell of a lot of very small pieces.
Gold, okay.
Jack surveyed the rooftops for any signs of stickies. Many times he had made reloads with gold bullion from a bank. The yellow stuff was just as good as gray lead for bullets, almost as if they were the same stuff, only different colors. No, nothing was wrong with finding a load of gold. Going to the cab of the armored truck, JB tricked the lock and cracked the door a hair, allowing the century-old air to escape in a whispery sigh. Its passage made the two corpses slump forward slightly, as if suddenly tired. As the ancient death fumes cleared, the armorer swung open the corroded door with a squeal of hinges and reached in to remove the keys from the ignition and toss them to Ryan. The other man made the catch and then started for the rear to check inside the vehicle. Climbing onto the step of the front cab, JB carefully removed the shotguns from the crumbling hands of the dead men. Working the stiff pump to eject the shells, he got 10 before the second shotgun gave a loud crack and jammed solid, the pump no longer able to move in either direction. 8 of the shells cracked apart into dried powder and shot when the armorer gently squeezed the plastic housing, but the 2 remained firm, and he lovingly tucked those into empty loops on his belt. Checking the seat, he found a box of ammo, but spilled coffee had splashed onto the cardboard, and over the decades, the brass base of the shells had crusted over, making them useless. Rummaging under the front seat on the other side, Doc unearthed several road flares in good condition, the waxy cylinders fogged with age, but still intact. However, whether they would ignite was problematic at best. He tucked them away.
The proof of the pudding
is in the eating.
Mildred located a first aid kit in the glove compartment and slipped it into her satchel with the other medical supplies. Most likely, everything it contained would be useless, but even the plastic box itself would be good to keep her small supply of bandages dry and clean. Without a qualm, Jack removed a cap from the driver and took the MP's sunglasses. Sliding them into place on his face, the polarized lens darkened in response to the bright desert sunlight, and the albino nodded. Reaching the rear of the wag, Ryan stopped short at the sight of the single thick door twisted off its row of hinges, the steel battered and torn. But the metal was bent outward, not inward. Something had escaped from the military vehicle, and he could guess what it was. Christie stood alongside the scowling man and echoed his thoughts.
The Sec Hunters!
Turning, Ryan frowned at the buildings, cars, and stores nearby, searching for any sign of movement. But the area was quiet.
Damn things must have been en route to somewhere when Skydark hit. Maybe even the Grandee Redoubt. And they've been sitting here on their tin asses, warm with juice from the nuke batteries until the dome cracked.
They probably read that as an act of aggression and activated themselves to repel the invaders.
Mildred worked the bolt on her Remington Long Blaster. Only 4 rounds remained, but she planned on making every shot count. Her Czech ZKR pistol would be used for millipedes and stickies. The big bore bone shredders were reserved exclusively for the lethal military robots.
You mean to repel us?
Then, without further comment, Dean took a stance toward the swinging sign and worked the arming lever of his new crossbow to knock a fiberglass arrow into place. The droids were smart and might decide to try to get close using the noise of the sign as cover. In a swell of fatherly pride, Ryan noted the boy's actions, then returned to the van, knowing his back was secure. Inside were floor brackets about the size of the base of a Sec Hunter, power cables dangling impotently from the ceiling, a bank of meters and dark vid screens flanking the 2 spots. For Ryan, the number was deeply reassuring. It was just the 2 they had seen so far then, and no more. There were also some skeletons at the front of the wag, strapped into seats, with steel briefcases chained to their wrists, the dusty uniforms hanging loosely off the wizened corpses of the officers. Holstered at their sides were a couple of plastic boxes, like the remote control of a vid. Snapping loose a restraining strap, Ryan slid the device from its holster, and it crumbled in his grasp, completely eaten through by the leaking acid of its own batteries. He tried again with the other, and got the same results. Chilled by sheer time.
These must have been the remotes to control the droids.
Anything else?
Glancing at the briefcases, Ryan saw a logo on the stainless steel lock, and knew better than to waste time trying to get inside those. Most likely it was the best the government at the time had. Even if they were successful, he knew it was possible that the cases were booby-trapped.
Nothing here for us. We better move in case the machines return to check on their masters.
That was a sobering thought, and the companions quickly departed the area and didn't stop until they were a good 2 blocks away. From there, the cliff rose above the low buildings at the outskirts of the city. Loose rubble from the salt dome lying in plain sight, some sections a dozen yards thick, others broken into a million small crystals the size of a fist. Loose white salt covered the streets inches deep, a few mounds rising over fire plugs and bodies, making the area look like Alaska in the winter. Crunching through the salt, they reached the base of the cliff and studied the rock face. It was as they had feared. The cliff was a sheer vertical rise, without ledges or cracks to use for climbing. Even worse, the plain of the city seemed to be larger than the cliff above, so that any climb would be partially inverted, the climbers hanging downward.
Time to reload. Deathlands is continued on the next CD.